Ladies and gentlemen, once again, welcome back our panelists.
Well, obviously, this has been a very lively discussion, continues to be a lively discussion. We were presented with six questions, which had been boiled down from something closer to 20. We're going to take a shot at answering them all in the brief time available. The first question is, with so much focus and investment on large emitters like China, India, and Brazil, how should we be thinking about alternatives and options for the rest of the developing world to address the intersection of climate change and development? And I'm going to throw that first to Ogunlade Davidson.
Thank you, John. First of all, let us just look at what's happening in the developing world. We start with Brazil, which uses quite a lot of biomass and have been doing it for quite some time, and they intend to continue to do it. China is, of course, having the highest growth at this point in time, but they're also using significant amounts of different types of energy sources to cope with this association. And then when we talk about India, the same thing. Now, what are these options that they are using, and how can these options be replicated within the wider developing world? One of the most important options is that of biofuels. Biofuels is being used. It's used in my part of the world, but completely inefficiently, and people would move away from it. The second one is using things like hydro resources. Now, the knowledge we have now for hydro resources is far better than what we used to have. There are significant amounts of improvement in the way we rehabilitate the people who may be affected by the dam construction. There are a lot of things that you can do much better now than we used to do it before. Probably some might be more expensive. There is the runoff river system, which has improved much better than what we used to. We have the Solar Energy Association. The Solar Energy Association is a bit more difficult. First of all, a lot of the countries have the sun, but to use solar energy usefully, you have to concentrate it and then convert it to what you want to use it. And at times, that can be costly for quite some countries. Then you have wind. For countries that do have wind energy, the development of wind energy is quite significant and it's very useful. But not all countries have the wind. Especially the ones near the equator do not have the wind. So wind energy may not be as useful as they can be. Then you have other different types of technologies. But one thing that I should summarize this is, to use some of these technologies are expensive. And some of these countries have priorities, of which may not match up with some of the cost of these technologies. So they need to be assisted for those technologies to be used. And that is where the climate debate has to extend to that aspect of how do we assist some of these countries to use some of these technologies.
Craig Venter, do you want to add a word about the biological side of that question?
Well, in fact, I see more interest in the developing world than in the developed world for new biological solutions, in part because of being agricultural countries. But also, it's possible the new versions of OPEC will be the ones that can convert to biofuels. Use their agriculture that's not usable for food to be one of the sources for energy for new biofuels. But also one of the big problems with energy is fresh water. We actually have prototype biological fuel cells that can take waste, whether it's for a village or for a home, and convert that into fresh water and develop energy at the same time. So there's possibly distributed systems that will very cheap and able to implement because it's biology, not some complicated technology.
Good. Another big question on the list, given the emissions of greenhouse gases and conventional pollutants from coal, wouldn't it be better just to invest in renewable energy and batteries to store the power from renewables rather than investing in capture and sequestration technology? David Hawkins, I'll throw that one to you.
Well, I'm not going to surprise anyone with my answer. This is not an instead of question. We need to apply maximum energy to reform all of these options. We need to do efficiency, as I mentioned. We need to do renewables. Both of those can be seen as ways of minimizing the dependence on fossil fuel. But remember the statistics that I gave you, every 3 days, a coal plant starts. And unless you've got a viable program in place now that can scale up to address those coal plants that are in the pipeline, pursuing a renewables instead of approach is going to let a lot of coal plants be built that will operate for 60 years and not deal with their carbon.
Thank you. There were two questions on this list about nuclear energy, and I'll direct them both to Anne Lauvergeon. The first one is, isn't the cost of disposing of nuclear waste a big unknown at this point, which makes nuclear energy risky from a business and social cost perspective? And the second and somewhat related question is there a way to bring stronger governance and accountability to nuclear energy systems in order to increase public confidence? So, Anne, take a shot at those.
Disposing nuclear waste is more a political issue, a political challenge than a technological challenge. We know now how to recycle, as I said a while ago, 96% of the spent fuel, and to put the residues in a chemical form, shape, which is totally inert. So the problem is to make it acceptable where you have to put it. And what is really interesting is to see that in the countries where it has been addressed, this issue has been addressed very seriously in a very democratic way with a lot of debates, public debates and so on, in Finland and in Sweden and also in France, it has been solved. So, and not for unknown amount of money, but for very well-known amount of money. For instance, in Finland, it costs around 300 million euros. So they have not a lot of spent fuel, but it shows that it is at a very reasonable cost. So the problem is a political issue to make sure that the appropriate debates, the appropriate openness, transparency, so in my view, it's a key issue. And you know, the nuclear industry has suffered a lot about secretive habits, secretive ways of making things. It has to be over. In Areva, it's totally over, and we are fully open to the societies. For global governance, IEA is a remarkable organization awarded by the Nobel Prize of Peace. Mohamed El Barada is in its organization in 2005. They are doing an incredible work, but in my view, and it's not in my view only, but also in the view of Mohamed El Barada, they need more money, more people, more capacities, to make to be even more efficient. On country by country, I may say that what is really important is to have a global governance country by country seriously achieved. So it means that for some country, it's clear that nuclear, they are not ready for nuclear because they have not the appropriate organization to address this kind of issues.
Thank you. One of the fundamental truths about energy options is there is no free lunch. There is no energy option out there that is free completely of uncertainties, risks, liabilities of various kinds. And to underline that, one of the questioners asked, what about the risks and unintended consequences from synthetic genes? How do those compare to the benefits of using synthetic genes? So I thought I'd let Craig Venter comment at least briefly on that balance.
Well, in fact, the field of synthetic genomics has probably had more bioethical review before the first experiments were done than any field in modern science. But it's very easy with organisms to make sure they don't live outside of the environment that they're intended to. Reactors or laboratories, and that's been the case with the last 30 years of molecular biology. with tens of millions of experiments, the E. coli that we all use is designed not to survive outside of the laboratory, even with altered genes. I think it's an issue of new areas and new ideas always seem frightening at first to many people. The concerns are certainly well worth dealing with in a comprehensive fashion, and the teams doing the science have been trying to do this in parallel.
Thank you. The last question is one that I think I will give each of the panelists a shot at. It's what should government do to accelerate private capital investments in the solutions we've been talking about? And David Hawkins, I think I'm going to start with you on that one.
Okay. The most important thing that government can do is turn protecting the climate into a good business proposition. Now, how does the government do that? Well, it does it by establishing some intelligent policies that make emitting greenhouse gases a scarce proposition. That's what the market is based on. It's based on scarcity. You do that with performance standards. You do that with things like cap and trade systems. Some would advocate a tax. Myself, I think a tax is an indirect method, and I think it's politically challenging. I prefer the direct method of establishing an environmental target, a limit on emissions, a performance standard. And that will create a predictable market for entrepreneurs to go in, raise capital, and pursue this based on a good business plan rather than the model that we've been following up to now, which is every year Congress takes a while to appropriate some research and development dollars, and the part of the business that thinks applying for government grants is worth spending some time on puts in an application and tries to get some money. But it's not really a business plan. It's just something to do to get some money for free.
And you run a very big corporation. What's your take on what government needs to do to accelerate private capital investment in solutions?
In my view, first, the most important thing is to make the maximum right now and not to wait for solutions tomorrow or to say, okay, we are going to have the silver bullet in some decades to come. So action now, it means actions on many fields. Actions for energy efficiency, so to have a lot of encouragements to all the in terms of regulations, but also could be taxation or subsidies to push energy efficiency, and also to make people more citizen, more aware of this issue. I think that we need country by country to launch advertising campaigns on that. Secondly, I think that we have to use all the sources of electricity, of energy without CO2 emissions to encourage those sources, so hydro, nuclear, solar, wind, biomass. And ourselves, we are not only nuclear, we are also in other sources of electricity without CO2 emissions. And I think that we have to, the governments have to encourage and to spend more money on R&D programs, especially for storage of CO2. It's not so obvious technologically. And in my view, those programs have to be more international than they are now.
Good. Craig, you obviously intend ultimately to be in the business. In fact, you already are in the business in a number of ways of developing some of the advanced biological options. So what more do you need from government?
Well, government's making very little investment in this country, at least, and the investments they're making are quite false by subsidizing corn growth or corn into ethanol, which just is not sustainable. It's not even a good fuel to be producing right now. My concern is a slightly more longer term, as we and others are successful in rolling out renewable fuels. I think it would be very useful to have a tax on non-renewable carbon sources like oil and coal. Once there's new fuels that are out there, it will drop the cost of oil and the price of oil, and we have to fight not switching back to using more oil because it becomes cheaper because now there's no alternatives.
Good, thank you. Ogun, how does this business of accelerating private capital investment look in the developing countries?
The important aspect is that in most countries, especially in developing countries where the private capital may not be there, the government has to show leadership. And the government has to show leadership in terms of policies, and the private would definitely try to keep to those. I give an example in Nigeria. In Nigeria, 75% of the associated gas in oil production is flared. Now, the government has clearly come out and said by 2010, the flaring should reduce to 6%. I can tell you now that most of the private companies are now reducing the flaring by coming up with LNG plants, and they have made a significant difference to the society. But it's government that has to come up with the policy, and the private company will follow.
Good. Thank you. I now want to offer the floor to David Sandilow, our fearless leader in this series of workshops on energy and climate, to tell us what the groups came up with in terms of the themes. David.
Thanks, John, and thanks to everybody. What a discussion. Unbelievable. The ideas were flooding back to the theme team. So we were able to capture just a little bit of what came back, and let me give you the top themes. You know, no surprise, the top idea that came back on the most critical priority was guess what? Pricing carbon, which, you know, it clearly emerged yesterday as our top theme, and it's what we keep on hearing. A lot of discussion of coal. No new coal, somebody said. Kill coal was another comment that came back. We got, there's a lot of people drank their coffee this morning. Somebody else said a big fat carbon tax was their proposal. So, somebody said any utility that builds a new coal plant has to close an old inefficient one down. As a proposal. A lot of discussion of U.S. action. The U.S. must get serious. A lot of discussion of public education. Somebody suggested campaigns similar to drunk driving. A lot of discussion of the global framework, as was discussed in the plenary this morning, with suggestions for a Marshall Plan for climate, for a global climate core, and an interesting suggestion that we could have asked Secretary Paulson about, revoking countries' banking rights if they do not address emissions, similar to money laundering systems. And a lot of discussion promoting innovation with money, prizes, a Manhattan Project, and technology standards. And believe me, this was only a fraction of what came back. It's all we were able to capture in the time allotted. Many, many interesting ideas for what CGI members can do to help make a difference. I'm going to report on a few of them, but we're capturing all of them, and we will definitely feed this into the conference planning system. Let me just report on a few. Somebody said every CGI member should commit to buying offsets. Somebody was more specific and said everyone should commit to buying offsets from Craig Venter's projects. So that was interesting. A lot of proposals that I love, which is CGI should hold a totally green conference. And this, thank you. This is going to be a priority, and this is something we got to work on with these light bulbs up here and these plastic bottles in the room. Somebody said encourage commitments that are big impact, not only big dollar. I was really glad to see that because please help us. This is something we're trying to do. We are trying to get out the word that this is not just about money inputs. I mean, we value hugely big dollar commitments, but this is all about the impact in the real world. That is a very hard message often to convey in press and in lead paragraphs of stories, so please help us with getting out that message. Somebody said focus more on follow-up, which is also something we're trying to do. It was the idea behind our lunch yesterday where we brought out people to celebrate promises made and promises kept. And any ideas you all have about how we reward follow-up, not just making promises, is something we're very interested in. Somebody suggested a very interesting idea that CGI should do an annual meeting with a Facebook-type internet service, and we'd like to learn more about that. We actually have a site up on YouTube, right now, which I recommend you go to. There's already some great content on YouTube from this meeting, but we'd love to know more about what we should be doing on Facebook and other social networking sites. Somebody said a session next year bringing together climate, health, poverty, and education. I thought that was a very interesting idea. And finally, somebody said CGI should go global. So just a short snippet, a bunch of great ideas, and there are a lot more, and they've all been captured in. My favorite gem that came in was the theme team is doing great. So thanks very much.
We have about 1 minute per person to respond to those themes from the room.
a lot of interesting and provocative stuff there. I think what I'm going to do, rather than try to orchestrate a discussion amounting to 1 minute per person, is just offer each person the minute, and we'll just run down the row here to say what you want to say in reaction to those ideas or any other 1 minute or less point you'd like to make that hasn't yet got out on the table. Ogun.
Thank you, John. I think one aspect that I like about the theme group is the whole idea of public education. I think the newspapers are trying, but there are times when they distort the facts. And we really need to send this message out wide and clear what the truths are and how individual can respond to the threats of climate change by our various habits and our actions, how governments can respond, how industry can respond. We need to get a lot of public education out there in all parts of the world, what the truths are.
Thank you. Anne Lauberjon.
I could repeat what you said, because in my view, it's absolutely key. The global awareness is much more important now than it was 2 years ago, but it remains very vague about what we can do, what it's possible to achieve now and in the future. In my view, it's a matter of education, it's a matter of discussion, it's a matter of debate, and not only debates for the eternity, but also of decisions. And to push the citizen to be more aware about this issue, the different issues, it's a way to push them, to push the governments to act now.
Thank you. David Hawkins.
I would say that the two biggest obstacles to change are beliefs that are in the minds of too many corporate officials and government officials, and they are, one, that we have time to address this problem and no need to rush, and second, that addressing this problem is going to be hugely painful and costly. So if I would leave you with two thoughts, it would be to go back and convey the message that, one, we do not have time. We have to act now. And second, this is not a painful proposition. This is an opportunity. The world is going to value low-carbon energy systems, low-polluting ways of operating a growing economy. There's money to be made on this. The money that is going to be spent protecting the climate is not going to Pluto. It's staying right here on planet Earth.
And Craig Venter.
I think an important part of biological solutions that may not be obvious to everybody is that the energy with most of these systems can be produced locally where it's consumed. Everybody's thinking about supporting the continued existence of the infrastructure that we have with ships and tankers and pipelines and refineries. With biology, it can be as simple as recycling the waste with a biological fuel cell at a home, a village, a city, a nation. And I think when we think of these distributed possibilities, it changes at least how I think about conquering the scale issue that we have to capture.
Thank you. That leaves me a minute to make a closing observation as the moderator of this panel. I want to start by thanking the panelists, who were extraordinary in not only the quality of their interventions, but in staying within time. And certainly I want to thank this extraordinary room full of people, which came up with a number of excellent interventions. Earlier this year, a report was released with considerably less fanfare than the IPCC, and appropriately so, because it was fewer people in a shorter time period. But it was a report by a group called the Scientific Expert Group on Climate Change and Development. It was put together by the UN Foundation and the scientific society Sigma Xi. It was co-chaired by Peter Raven and Rosina Bierbaum. I know Rosina is here. I don't know if Peter is here. There were 18 members from 11 countries, and it was tasked with making recommendations to the United Nations Commission on Sustainable Development and the Secretary General about what should actually be done about climate change. It had a different mandate than the IPCC in that respect, in that the IPCC is not asked to make recommendations. It's asked to evaluate the state of the science and the options, but not to make recommendations. We did make some, and they were equally divided along mitigation and adaptation. Indeed, the subtitle of the report was Avoiding the Unmanageable and Managing the Unavoidable, a symmetric proposition in which, of course, avoiding the unmanageable means what we have to do in mitigation so that the amount of climate change does not get beyond the capacity of adaptation to deal with tolerable consequences, and managing the unavoidable means what do you do to reduce the impacts of climate change you can't avoid. And I simply want to emphasize that our whole focus in this group has been by design on mitigation. But that doesn't mean that any of us should be unaware of the importance of the adaptation side of the question and the increased attention that that's going to need from governments, from citizens, from NGOs, and from companies in the years ahead. Because no matter how well we do on the mitigation tasks that we've been talking about here this morning, we're going to need to do much more on the adaptation side as well. With that, I would like to ask General Wesley Clark to come to the stage. General Clark is a senior fellow at UCLA's International Institute Burkle Center. He's a retired four-star general who has been in the national spotlight for a number of reasons. He served in the United States Army for 33 years, rising to four stars. His career included service as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander. In that position, he oversaw Operation Allied Force, NATO's... He's worried I'm taking too much of his time. General Clark.
Stuff than this. It's great to see you all here today. Look, we have this custom at the Clinton Global Initiative of recognizing the people who are making commitments to do great things. And I'd like to recognize some this morning. First, I'd like to ask Tom Peterson to come up on stage with me. He's Executive Director of the Center for Climate Strategies. And Tom, come on up here. His commitment is that he's going to help all Americans from all sectors learn more about the importance of sustainable and long-term climate-based legislation. This is a $500,000 one-year commitment. And here's what they're going to do. They're basically going to move from working with state and elected officials, media, and the public. They're going to move it broader to scale up the state-level work to produce a federal climate policy blueprint that's going to chart a movement away from business as usual, going well beyond just carbon trading and into all other areas in which we can work for sustainable global growth and fixing our climate problems. Is that about right, Tom?
Very good.
I know I got the dollars right. It's a $500,000 commitment, and we appreciate
it. Thank you
very
much.
And I'd like to give you the certificate to memorialize the commitment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next I'd like to ask a group to come up on stage. And this includes Mindy Luber, who's the president of Ceres. Reed Detchon, who's the Executive Director of Energy Future Coalition, Tim Wirth, President of the UN Foundation, and Jim Mahoney, the Director of Public Policy at the Bank of America. So can you all come up here very quickly and... This is a multi-million-dollar commitment over 5 years to support the creation of a national task force in order to meet the goal of doubling the U.S. rate of efficiency, energy efficiency improvement. So basically, Ceres is partnering with the UN Foundation and the Bank of America to create a diverse and powerful coalition to build awareness and catalyze the deployment of improvements in energy efficiency with a goal of doubling U.S. energy efficiency by 2012. It's a $3 million commitment. It'll create a task force on energy efficiency, bring together business leaders, consumer, labor, environmental groups, identify a limited number of the best opportunities to advance energy efficiency at the state as well as national levels, and formulate a national action plan to realign economic incentives. It's a big agenda, and it's a big commitment, and it's great to recognize it here today. Thank you all. Thank you. And we have one for everybody.
Yep.
Okay, we're gonna cut this. We're gonna cut this up into fourths, and everybody's gonna get it as they work on it.
Bring it to each meeting of the task force.
Thank you.
Okay, next I'd like to recognize David Mills, who's the founder and chairman of Alstra, and Peter Darby, who's the chairman and CEO of Pacific Gas and Electric. This is a larger commitment. This is a $3 billion construction, $1 billion operational commitment to develop solar thermal plants in Florida and California. And here's the deal. PG&E and Alstra commit to build 1,000 megawatts of concentrating solar power plants over the next 5 years at a cost of $3 billion to provide reliable power competitively priced against fossil fuels. Congratulations, and we really appreciate it. Thank you. That is so wonderful. Thank you. Next, I'd like to recognize Kalisa Karuretua, who's from the Embassy of the Republic of Rwanda, and Ted Townsend, the founder and chairman of Earth Park and Great Ape Trust. Can you all come up here? Are they here? Yep. Oh, great. Hi, Kalisa. How are you? That's it. So here's the commitment to establish a national reserve in the nation of Rwanda to promote reforestation and conservation of great apes. It's a tens of millions of dollars commitment. It's an exciting partnership to deliver the benefits to climate and to the people of Rwanda and to biodiversity. President Kagame of Rwanda has decided to set aside an extraordinary amount of tropical forest in perpetuity as the Rwanda National Conservation Park. And Ted, through his charities Earth Park and Great Ape Trust, will establish a field station in this park to advance international scientific research, promote reforestation, and help protect the great apes. Thank you very much for this. And let's recognize it. It's moving in the water at the entrance, right?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And now just to recognize some other groups who've also made great commitments. Before we close, let me recognize Sunil Paul. He's a managing director of Spring Ventures. He's announcing something called Gigaton Throwdown. It's a world-class meeting of the top minds in the world of clean energy, investors, entrepreneurs, technologists, to identify the roadmap to ensure that investments get the biggest greenhouse bang for the buck. They're aiming for a serious impact on climate change on the order of 1 gigaton. That's 1 billion tons. No, that's not right.
That is.
Doesn't sound right. Of carbon dioxide reduction every year. So any investors and others out there, please look up Sunil Paul. He'll be here right after the meeting. Also, Bracken Hendricks from the Center for American Progress and Rick Fedrizzi and Michelle Moore from the U.S. Green Building Council. They're here representing a new partnership inspired by a Clinton Global Initiative between their organization and ECLAY, the local governments for sustainability. So they'll be the lead partners. Together, they're going to create a Green City Index that ranks U.S. cities on environmental action on a research-based checklist. It'll be based on U.S. city leadership to date for key actions to advance climate protection and sustainable development. That's examples of some of the ideas and commitments that come out of Clinton Global Initiative, and we encourage all of you to participate and be on the stage with us later or next year. Thank you. Well, thank you, General Clark, and again, I thank the panel, I thank the audience, and I think we should all thank David Sandalo and his team who have put together this terrific series.
Ladies and gentlemen, a few housekeeping notes. For those of you who are going to the Carnegie Hall event this evening, please pick up your tickets in the Hudson Bar member registration area in the hotel lobby. The plenary session begins at 12:30. Thank you.